This talk is about an interesting application of software-defined networking to enable I/O virtualization. Needless to say, being from UMC, it's got a storage bent to it, but it's probably a little demented storage bent. Disclaimer, in order for me to provide these slides, I had to put up a company disclaimer. So, everything that I'm presenting here is I actually got off the internet. So there's nothing proprietary, nothing really novel in isolation. It's more the application of SDN, I think, that's most novel about what I'm going to present. So the presentation breaks down into four parts. And we'll start out with just talking about the shift from terminal computing to mobile computing. Then we'll talk about virtualizing the I/O stack, specifically the storage I/O stack. The application of IP networking in that context. And then an interesting way of scheduling bandwidth in support of that. So this was the abstract for the talk. I'll just assume you guys have seen this. About me, I'm 30 years into my career. I've worked on East Coast large distributed systems for that entire period. Most of my career has been working with enterprise, so I've only been at EMC about 4 years. At EMC, I've worked on the cloud infrastructure from Atmos. Most recently, I do research and advanced development in the office of the CTO. All right, so this portion of the talk is really focused on the explosion of data and kind of asserts that that came from the shift away from desktop computing and prior to that, terminal computing, and the move outside the brick and mortar of enterprise into the mobile universe. So most of my 30 years, everyone sat at their desktop and they connected pretty much just like a green screen terminal to a data center relatively close by to an office building. And that's been the way computing worked for decades. That's not the way computing works really anymore. End users, machines, everything that connects to what's sitting in the data center is really not inside brick and mortar, or for the most part isn't. And the multiplier of that scale has had a dramatic impact on the amount of data that we have to deal with. Part of that has brought some interesting contrast between the way enterprises run their data centers and the way HPC and especially cloud entities run their data centers. I worked at Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch for quite a while, and we talked about economies of scale in that context, but they're dwarfed. Those economies are dwarfed by the economies of scale realized by these large global data center operators. That's really one of the key outcomes of this transition from terminal-based computing to mobile computing. One of the biggest challenges with that over the past 10 years, the thing that's really of most interest to me is, you know, there was this huge push initially away from centralized storage and the adoption of local disk, mostly at a time when bandwidth was incredibly expensive. You know, if you think of a Cisco line card 20 years or 10 years ago, circa 2003, that was a lot of money. Bandwidth was really, really expensive. And so it made a lot of sense to try to avoid the network wherever possible. And so local disk became the way to deal with data. But local disk has all kinds of issues at scale because local disks have this beautiful property of breaking all the time. And so there's been this combination of the explosion of data and really, really, really cheap bandwidth to centralize, at least logically centralize, data on disk away from computation. And that's kind of non-intuitive. We'll talk a little bit more about that. So this slide just it's caught my eye on the internet. This slide kind of captures that explosion of data when we moved outside of the data center to create all of that data. So when you put the creation of data in the hands of people with mobile devices, with cameras, as an example, or the ability to watch video from those smartphones, there's a massive multiplier of the amount of data created. And there's all kinds of scenarios now at large-scale distributed distributions that where people are creating data in a very diverse set of scenarios. But the problem with that is that data and infinite growth, data has this really interesting characteristic that after a couple of weeks of its initial creation and lifetime, it's the probability of it ever being accessed again is almost zero. Different workloads create different types of data, and those have different characteristics. But in general, data has that frequently accessed for a short period of time and then never accessed again characteristic. And so if you just let it infinitely grow, you're not going to achieve the goal of economies of scale. And the traditional way of viewing data with RAID and mirroring so that we have at least two or more copies of the data doesn't really hold up under this massive load of data creation. So there's been this big push to move away from RAID, to move away from mirroring, and get down below two copies of your data. And that has massive repercussions in terms of the ability to achieve economies of scale and also really change the storage paradigm. So distributed storage with erasure codes is a way to get away from RAID. The interesting thing about erasure codes in this context is you can't get away from mirroring if you keep the paradigm of dual site redundancy for disaster recovery. So that's kind of the traditional enterprise view. You can get a lot of benefits from adopting erasure code as a replacement for RAID, but you can't get away from mirroring if you do that. So you're still caught, you're still stuck with 2 plus the overhead, 2x plus the overhead of RAID in terms of redundancy. And that's ignoring tape backups and all that stuff. So what recently has occurred over the last couple of years is there's been a push, probably most visibly by Microsoft and the Azure team, for multi-site erasure coding. And multi-site erasure coding has this beautiful property that you get to store less than two times the data. So you get rid of that mirroring property. that has some pretty interesting benefits when one of the goals is to achieve economies of scale. So I believe every one of the large operators does this today. Google, Microsoft Azure, Facebook, and presumably Amazon. So what's probably most interesting about this, though, this is logically centralized storage. You can't use this data in the way that you use traditional RAID-based storage. The implication is you've got some kind of library that you're accessing this with. So we're going to refer to this as virtualizing I/O. That library is a gateway to back-end storage. It's an abstraction that gets leveraged in a variety of ways. So I/O forwarding is a mechanism that really has been promoted by the HPC community. And it had to do with the impedance mismatch between the dramatic rise in the number of cores and really slow storage. And also the file system, parallel file systems have this interesting characteristic that they have a proprietary library, and on leader class machines, the end nodes are fairly weak in terms of what they can support, and they're constrained in the operating system, and so they don't have the library to the parallel file system, so they don't have Lustre's client or GPFS, et cetera. So there was a need to basically have some way of abstracting away the parallel file system. So they introduced this intermediary, this I/O forwarding tier, to forward the IOs from those end stations back to the parallel file system. But it has an interesting characteristic because it has that intermediary position between storage and the end stations where the applications reside. The implication is I've introduced two independent networks. Storage now scales independently of the application. And that's a really interesting property to build on. So fairly common today with these large-scale systems is this notion of an intermediary that's forwarding IOs back to storage, but servicing the IO requests from the end applications. This is actually not specific to HPC, but you actually see this in a variety of ways, and we'll talk about that in a second. Okay, so, and really just to hone in on this a little bit more, this notion of an overlay file system and the presentation of a file system to the end station, to the application, that file system is just a Unix notion. So it can be non-POSIX compliant, or it can be fully POSIX compliant. But it actually is fairly pervasive. If you look in Linux today, in the kernel, the LIO target, SCSI target, has these semantics. I can use a client library to talk to a backend storage array or even Ceph and present that as an iSCSI LUN, as a SAS local device, or even a FCOE target over the network in the front end. I can do that with file. I can do that with object. So this abstraction is really interesting, this intermediary. And the other interesting thing about it is it's a storage level abstraction, so it knows the difference between reads and writes. One of the interesting things and part of the way that is emerging of how we talk to this back-end erasure-coded storage pool across multiple sites is through a client library. And this is very, very common. Here I'm showing the Ceph RBD library, Lustre, Gluster, and EMC's own object storage Atmos, and more recently Viper. There are a bunch of different ones out there. These are not the only ones. I just put these up as a sample. So the other interesting aspect of this is a really nice place to position flash and non-volatile memory. It has this interesting set of properties now where I can present pages and deal with pages in a way that provides consistency for my persistence, but allows for more user space semantics, so more RDMA-like performance characteristics. Here I just use a really trivial example of a project out there called Block Device and User Space to mmap and provide this intermediary tier with some pretty amazing performance. And this is the next example is more concrete. So this is a slide from a presentation some guys did a couple months ago from the NTT's Sheepdog project. So Sheepdog is just like Ceph, Lustre, et cetera, et cetera. They all have these characteristics. It's yet another storage backend that provides support for distributed erasure coding. Very, very common design paradigm that's emerging. All right, so the next part of this is we don't need InfiniBand or anything but IP really to provide support for this, which has this beautiful property of scaling very widely and being very well understood both from the application developers and from the infrastructure operators. So a lot of discussion over the last couple days on this new networking paradigm. This is some diagrams that were presented by at Hot Interconnects this year by Cisco. This shift from this kind of core edge traditional networking to this flat, high, massive amounts of bandwidth networking paradigm is really being driven broadly. Everyone that I know is really pushing to make this transition. So this isn't something that is germane to just a small group of cloud providers. I think everyone's looking to do this. One of the most interesting things about the transition is the bandwidth on the right is almost infinite, in essence, in the context of the fabric that's built. And it's incredibly cheap. Unlike 10 years ago, when we built networks like depicted on the left, where it was incredibly expensive, network bandwidth on the right is the cheapest component in the hardware mix. And that lets us build fabrics out of Ethernet and IP. So typically, when we talk about fabrics at EMC, we're talking about Fibre Channel. In HPC, it's usually InfiniBand. Today, when we talk about fabrics, we're talking about multipath routed IP predominantly. And that's a pretty interesting emergence to build fabrics out of those basic building blocks. And the reason that it's interesting is we have a lot more control over this network. We know how to deal with IP. We know how to deal with Ethernet. And we've been doing this for a long, long time. And so the thing that becomes really interesting is how do we connect storage and compute in a way that really exploits that intermediary tier of I/O forwarding and allows us to build systems that perform more like InfiniBand or Fibre Channel, but at massive scale across multiple sites. And the idea is to basically build logical switches, programmable switches, out of these fabrics. So IP is frequently used as an overlay. You know, if you think of it, the IP network is an overlay on Ethernet naturally. But typically, we don't deal a lot with the QoS at the IP level and that connectivity. Typically, that's undefined. But what if we didn't do that? What if we actually scheduled that bandwidth, just like we schedule storage and compute? What if we did that in the context of the schedules of compute and storage? This is very much how Fibre Channel and InfiniBand are used in that context. So remember, a logical switch, just like a switch, it has interconnectivity between the ports on that switch, and it has queues as frames transit the switch from source to destination. All right, so if we're gonna schedule bandwidth, what we'd really like to be able to do is we'd like to take advantage of container-based virtualization or hypervisor virtualization. We wanna be agnostic to that level of virtualization, but we want to exploit it because it gives us a nice property of IP virtualization. We're able to exploit VIPs to control the bandwidth. And we really don't have to trade off response time to do that. So in this diagram, what I've depicted is a fabric. This fabric is very much just built out of component switches and routers. And host with 10 gig Ethernet NICs, fairly commodity, easily accessible components. And the one thing I'll point out is the switches really don't even need to be touched to achieve this goal. I can use basically a software switch on the host to control how the VIPs get set up. And once I've done that, I have quite a bit of control just from a routing standpoint. So I can leverage other capabilities of this network to go further in the isolation and the performance of the network, but IP itself is routed, and I can exploit that as soon as I can get to an IP position on the network. And I can do that right at the source application. So how many people are familiar with network namespaces in Linux or Crossbow and Solaris? So those are pretty amazing because they let me virtualize the network stack without really giving up performance at all. So I get bare metal TCP IP stack, and I can partition the host with each partition getting its own network stack. All right, so the way that this is achieved, though, is I need some kind of controller, okay? This controller is referred to as an SDN controller, but when I worked on InfiniBand, it was referred to as a subnet manager. This is not a new concept at all. Fiber channel services are very much in the same vein. The difference is that the controller is actually factored out of the network. It's not baked into the hardware. That allows us to expose the internal state of the network, which is within the controller, to a scheduler. And we can vet that scheduler's state against the state of the compute scheduler and the storage scheduler. And so that allows us quite a bit of control over how we actually wire up our applications. Particularly interesting for me is where the applications have that property of an M-to-N mapping where I scale both my client tier and my middle tier horizontally. So my file system is scaling horizontally and the clients accessing that file system are scaling horizontally as an example. So that typically that fan-in was an uncontrolled characteristic of a cluster previously. Now we can actually control that fan-in very precisely. So these are examples of controllers that have emerged. VMware bought Nicira last year. That's an example. Microsoft Azure has been pretty public about how they use a controller they developed. Google's B4 network uses a controller called Onyx, or as a derivative of that. And then the Open Networking Lab has recently open sourced a network controller that's also a derivative of Onyx. So these controllers, though, are really just factoring out the internal tables that are managed by the network devices. A network device or a set of network devices can be thought of as a distributed key value store. The forwarding state is really exactly the same as a distributed key value store. So what if we factored it out of the network and then exploited that information to our advantage? And that's really what we're talking about doing here. So here's the kind of the survey of some of the controllers out there. These are by no means the only ones. This is like one of the most popular areas of development right now. The one that I just wanted to highlight, though, is the last one since it's open source. So in this example, this is an example application that's been shown around a couple of times this year. It's also very similar to some of the public comments that have been made in the IETF by Microsoft in the use of BGP. But this notion of BGP or IP peering through the use of a controller is actually very, very powerful. And this is just illustrating how we do that with the ONS open source controller. And so the way it works is we have a route server that's paired with the routing environment. It has all of the tables being updated, so it knows the state of the network. And then it can insert routes because it's a peer of the routers. And so once we can insert routes, we know the layout of the network, we can control the connectivity between two networks, in this case, two IP networks. We can control their peering. This is how IXPs, Internet Exchange Points, do this today. And so there's a lot of interest in this application in the context of Internet Exchange peering. Just a little bit more. Again, we're just building a distributed system. We're just building a key value store that's managing the state of the network and then precisely configuring that network. And a lot of times that's referred to as DevOps for the network or programming the network. And it literally is based on this notion of a key value store. Okay. So at this point, the major things that I wanted to get across before we talk about the application is this amazing acceleration in the growth of data and the insanity of thinking we can store it in traditional ways. Like there's just no way you can do that. And so people have really, in those environments where they really have to deal with that, have started to adopt distributed storage without RAID and ideally without mirroring. And without mirroring, if you care about disaster recovery, if you care about high availability, then you've got to do something to protect the data over the long haul. And the most efficient way to do that, the most effective way, is to use multi-site erasure coding. Once you do that, though, you have a pretty big networking problem in terms of how you deal with the data and accessing the data, persisting it. And so this gives us a chance to leverage that IO forwarding intermediary, which introduces this notion of two networks. One network is the back-end storage, which is pooled across multiple sites. This intermediary IO forwarding tier, the IO forwarding tier now becomes a point of clustering. It's a point of reference for my data. And if it's available to me in multiple sites, and it has persistence, so it has non-volatile memory, flash as I depicted, I can basically have volumes. I can hydrate my data there. I can cache it as long as I maintain it and some boundary of consistency. So if we assume for a second that boundary is at a page boundary, I can manage pages there. I can present eventual consistent data to end applications who are left to deal with that. Well, I guarantee consistency across the back end and the persistence from an erasure coding standpoint. So to do that, I give up some space, but I'm going to exploit that property of the data that it's infrequently used after some period of time. So I just treat that as a cache. And I keep the data in some kind of volume form, call it a container. That container, because it's on page boundaries, can support being presented as a block device. It can support being presented as a file system, such as ButterFS or ext3, et cetera. Or it can be presented as a container a la S3 or any other of the other storage systems, object storage systems. So now I want to basically exploit that property of being able to present containers of data that are just basically a logical list of pages to end applications on a scheduled basis on the front end network, the application network. And this is the technique for scheduling. So now I've basically decoupled the persistence to the back end disks, and I've given the opportunity now to exploit this intermediary tier to present containers of data that will provide very high performance and provide all of the characteristics that we had in a SAN or a NAS filer, et cetera, but across multiple sites. So AutoVS is some technology that we've been investigating, and it really just is several techniques. We've demonstrated this at a couple of EMC and VMware venues this year, EMC World and VMworld. But basically, it's a set of techniques that just exploits the things that I was describing and allows you to schedule bandwidth. And the beauty of storage access is that it's a client-server metaphor. I interact, the client sends requests to the storage, and the storage responds. And so that network can be broken down into two components. One component is the central portion of the network, the intervening bandwidth. In that portion of the network, I want to maximize the bandwidth. I just want a lot of bandwidth. And storage is not a latency-sensitive type environment in this context. So I can go across a network through many stages of a fabric, and I'm not sensitive to nanosecond or microsecond latency. So once I have that kind of intervening bandwidth, that bisectional bandwidth piece under control, at the edges, I just want to model that fan-in property of M clients to N servers so that I maintain a balanced system. So I have two scheduling problems. One is really an operator problem of having enough bisectional bandwidth. And then the second is allowing the application to balance clients to service nodes. So what we want to be able to do is now model that with the network properties, the IP network, through just treating IP as an overlay. The way that I like to express this, because it's very expressive, is through, how many people know what supernetting is in IP networks? So if you think of a supernet's just a hierarchy of routing, of subnets. And so if I have all of my subnets sharing the same prefix, and I route through the supernet, it's a fairly easy thing to kind of model and to help people understand. And so that's kind of the idea. So this is an eyeful, so excuse me for the complexity. But basically, that's the concept, is I have a subnet, say a WAC20 subnet, and then I'm going to allocate two WAC24 subnets below that. Okay, so now I can schedule two types of connectivity. One is, in essence, circuits through the top of the network, and then the bottom of the network, I want to connect my virtual machines or my containers, which are either clients or servers, through that. And because this is a supernet built out of IP subnets, I can have many of these side by side, And I can reason about how much contention they have for the shared underlying physical infrastructure. So that's kind of the idea. So again, I'll just show some things that are on the, you know, openly available. This picture depicts the open source controller in conjunction with OSCARS, which was developed by ESNet. And it allows you to manage virtual circuits. And there are several projects out there that allow you to have bundles of virtual circuits. And so that becomes an easy way to kind of depict how we would build a manager of that middle bandwidth, that top of the supernet. And then the other thing that I want to be able to do now is bring up VIPs at the edge, and then those VIPs are allocated out of subnets that basically have the same prefix as my supernet. And that's trivial to do with a virtual switch. And so that's the idea, is to configure the virtual switches and exploit those. And they're widely available in Linux, in Windows, and Solaris, or in Illumos. And so with that in place, I can plug this framework into OpenStack or into any cloud stack and provide the ability to manage bandwidth between clients and data services. And by doing that, I can support multiple tenants side by side and provide, you know, a pretty good SLA around that connectivity. The other thing that this allows me to do is I can take the same techniques and use that for replication across sites. So this becomes interesting for network providers, MPLS providers, et cetera. One other interesting aspect of using IP is I can use ECMP across all the virtual channels in my spine, in my supernet. And so that gives me good load balancing of the traffic. And again, that's just using off-the-shelf routing techniques. And just the last thing is, I can actually manipulate the hardware queues using the virtual switch. So I can get access to InfiniBand-like properties on the host adapter on very low-end NICs. This doesn't take expensive NICs to manipulate the hardware queues on the NIC. And so with that, I have this view of the top-down view of my network now that I never had before. So from the controller, I can see all of the allocations of bandwidth, and I can model that, I can monitor it, and I can modify it over time. That's the presentation. So literally, these things are all available today. They're all scriptable from higher level languages. This is actually very straightforward. And I never mentioned OpenFlow once, so this doesn't depend on OpenFlow whatsoever. It uses networking routing protocols that are in your environment today. So even if this went horribly wrong, you could just shut it off and allow routing to take over. So it can be introduced in a fairly non-invasive way. Questions?
How do you? You showed there was a kind of a bandwidth manager where each group would accept a virtual path between two sites, and that bandwidth would be doled out. Is that based on VMs or source destination IP addresses or?
So it's based on subnets. So you basically...
You'll have a clatter of VMs that will share a single subnet, and everything in that is in the...
Actually, the ideal situation is where they don't share subnets. Mm-hmm. So then you can do IP failover and use standard BGP techniques for failing or moving things around. So what you'd really like to be able to do is route injection using BGP. And using BGP's IP failover properties, that allows you to basically exploit checkpoint restart to do migrations and things like that.
Okay.
Any other questions? All right, well, thank you.